Good day. Today is Tuesday, 28th October 2025. And before I proceed with the video, let me just remind you again to tick the like button if once you've heard or watched the video and have liked what you've heard and watched, you want to indicate that fact. Let's now proceed with the program, and we are now moving closer and closer to the meeting, the summit meeting between President Trump of the United States and President Xi Jinping of China. And I have made a number of comments recently about the fact that whilst members of the US administration have been very keen to give as optimistic a spin as possible about the progress of the trade negotiations between China and the United States, the Chinese have, by contrast, been taking a much more measured, at times I would say even icy, response to the news and have been basically playing down the extent of the progress made. Well, today it has gone further than that, and the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman has made certain comments in response to comments made by the US Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, and the tone, is frankly, borderline angry. And these comments of the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman are now receiving significant amount of coverage in the Chinese media. Global Times, which to repeat again, is a newspaper mostly published in English, though there's also, I understand, a Chinese version, but published in English and owned by the People's Daily, which is the official newspaper of the Communist Party of China. So it is perhaps not an entirely official newspaper exactly, but it is known to be very close to the leadership of China, and its coverage and its comments reflect very closely the views and opinions of the Chinese government. Anyway, they have given particular prominence to these comments of the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman about the comments made by Scott Bessent, and they relate precisely and specifically to the topic of rare earths. And the title of the article, which is published by Global Times, but of which there is no single author given, which, again, if you know Chinese and, by the way, Russian media practice, is an indication that this is a semi-official announcement, a publication, if you like, by the Chinese authorities. Anyway, the title of this article is Chinese Foreign Ministry Responds to Whether China's Rare Earth Export Control Measures Have Taken Effect After Bessent's Related Claims. A rather complicated title. But then it goes on to say this: responding to questions on whether China could clarify if its export control measures on rare earths have taken effect or are currently suspended, and if suspended, whether this relates to US tariff threats and recent China-US economic and trade consultations, following US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's claim on Sunday that China has never implemented these measures and that US threats to impose 100% tariffs on Chinese goods had influenced the negotiations. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Guo Xiaokun said at a press conference on Tuesday that specific details should be referred to the relevant Chinese authorities. Regarding the rare earth export control policy, Guo noted that China has repeatedly clarified its position. The measures in question are part of efforts to standardize and improve the export control system in line with international practices. They are intended to better safeguard world peace and regional stability whilst fully fulfilling non-proliferation and other international obligations. We are willing to strengthen dialogue and exchanges with all countries on export controls to maintain the security and stability of global industrial and supply chains, Guo said. Now, that is a very complicated way, a typically complicated way of China saying, on the eve of the meeting between President Trump and President Xi, that Scott Bessent is lying, that China has not modified its policy on the export of rare earths, that the recent changes in the export rules for rare earths remain in effect, that there has been no suspensions or anything of that kind, and China has not been intimidated and will not change its stance as a result of American threats to impose 100% tariffs on China. So this is a very chilly statement from the Chinese Foreign Ministry. And, well, it probably doesn't augur especially well for the discussions between President Trump and President Xi. On the Duran, my colleague and I, Alex Cristoforo and I, discussed some of the comments that President Trump himself has been making in advance of his meeting with President Xi. And we discussed how President Trump's comments that he wants China to modify its policies towards Russia and downgrade its economic policies with China, with Russia, and stop buying Russian oil, and that President Trump intends to discuss with President Xi China's relations with Russia and to try to enlist President Xi's help to put pressure on Russia with respect to the conflict in Ukraine. Well, Alex and I discussed all of this, and we said that not only will President Xi not welcome those comments from President Trump, not only will he make the point that the Chinese always make in all discussions with third parties whenever these are brought up, that China never at any time conditions its foreign economic policies with third parties because one particular state, in this case, the United States, doesn't like them. China maintains its sovereign right to make its economic and trade decisions by itself. Not only will that be Xi's response, but Xi will not be happy and will not take it well, and the authorities in China will not be happy and will not take it well, that Trump is introducing this entirely extraneous topic into a summit meeting intended to discuss Chinese-American trade and economic relations and the issues that divide these two countries in the Pacific, over Taiwan, and other matters of that kind. Again, President Trump may not understand this and may not be particularly willing to hear argument against this. But the very fact that we have had this trade agreement, this framework, it's not even a trade agreement, this framework discussion, which has, as far as I can see, basically kicked the can down the road. It's made it possible to move forward with the discussions that took place in Madrid in September. It basically extends the trade truce between China and the United States that was agreed then, with the Americans pulling back from imposing massive tariffs against China in return for what, as far as I can see, are token concessions from the Chinese. For example, the Chinese agreeing to buy more soybeans from the United States, but not making concessions, as far as I can see, on other key questions like rare earths. Anyway, the point is that the Chinese want to discuss all of these things. They want to discuss trade, they want to discuss business ties, they want to discuss the question of Chinese-built ships being charged fees in American ports. I'm not sure whether that idea has been dropped by the United States. If the American president comes and talks to the Chinese leader and talks about China's relations with Russia, it will be seen in Beijing as an unfriendly move by the United States. That, it seems to me, is something Americans find very difficult to understand. But the Chinese are not going to rush to accommodate American concerns when the Americans continue to show such entirely complete disregard for their own. Anyway, there we go. So we will see what happens over the course of this meeting between President Xi and President Trump. In the meantime, the Russians have made their own observations about their trade relations with both India and China. Boris Titov, co-chairman of the Russian-Chinese Committee for Friendship, Peace and Development, who is currently in China, made this comment to TASS. "Currently, Russian-Chinese trade and economic relations are at their highest point. In accordance with the direction set by the leaders of our countries, bilateral political ties are at the highest level, and the development of trade at economic contacts is a natural trend. Russian-Chinese trade and economic relations retain significant reserves for expansion." And Titov then went on to say that the volume of trade with China could potentially grow to the level of earlier indicators of turnover between Russia and the European Union, which is about 6 billion. I'm not sure 6 billion in relation to what matter, because to my knowledge, if we're talking about annual growth between China and Russia, it is already in excess of $200 billion dollars a year. Perhaps what is meant here is that trade turnover will increase a further 6 billion over the course of this year, which is entirely possible, by the way. Anyway, so the Russians saying that their trade relations with China are very good, and I don't get the sense that they are worried about their ability to export oil to China. Now, the Russians have also been talking about their economic relations with India. I said yesterday that the Russian energy minister has talked about India and Russia being in the process of agreeing a framework and joint committees to administer their seaborne trade for oil and such products. In fact, as I've now discovered, the energy minister said a great deal more. He said that there's been intense discussions between India and Russia about enhancing energy cooperation further, about Russia exporting to India coal, liquefied natural gas, all kinds of other energy products, and of course, apparently assisting India with its nuclear power generation program. So, anyway, the Russians are going out of their way to make it clear that, as far as they know, their economic relations with India and China remain intact. That doesn't mean that they're not recalibrating, as the Indians, for example, are. There's been much discussion about steps that Reliance, one of the big Indian refinery companies, has been taking. Supposedly, it's slowed imports of Russian oil, increased imports of US oil. Something, by the way, that is not unusual. It happens on a fairly regular basis. It's difficult to know exactly the significance of this. And I understand that India had actually, for a certain period, reduced Russian oil purchases even before, or rather well before, the recent American announcement of sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft. And, of course, on the Russian side, Lukoil, which is a private company, it is not state-owned. It's Russia's second biggest oil company. Rosneft is its biggest. But Lukoil is a private company, though Rosneft is a state-owned company. Anyway, Lukoil is divesting itself of its foreign holdings, which of course makes perfect sense because Lukoil must anticipate that the next wave of sanctions, which the Russians, by the way, believe is coming, will seek to divest Lukoil of and other companies, oil companies, Russian oil companies, of their external holdings. So it's better to sell them off before those sanctions come into force. So anyway, there is that recalibration. But the overall mood in Moscow about all of this is that whatever temporary blip the sanctions are going to cause, it's not going to make a huge amount of difference, and that the Russian economy will continue along its present path without much in the way of interruption, and that Russian oil exports and energy exports will continue on global markets, because even the United States cannot risk it being otherwise. Now, I say that, one can see the sentiment on Russian financial markets. The ruble has remained stable. There's been hardly any movement up or down in the ruble at all over the last couple of days. And the Russian stock market has also remained relatively stable as well. And the governor of the central bank, Elvira Nabiullina, has been making more comments about the economic situation. She seems to consider, as I do, that the main factor in determining economic growth in Russia is not these sanctions, but the Russian central bank's monetary policy. She's pointed out in a report she's given to the Duma, the Russian parliament, that since the high point of interest rates was reached in the early summer, the central bank has cut interest rates by 4.5 points. So there's been a significant, though not dramatic, reduction in interest rates. She said that the central bank has slowed the pace of interest rate reductions for the remainder of this year to take into account the effect mostly of a VAT increase, which the Russian government has announced. And also, there's apparently been a surge in prices of some vegetables and fruits at this point in the year. She pointed out that food prices fell earlier than usual in Russia over the course of the summer and are rising earlier than usual over the course of the autumn. These are entirely seasonal factors. And there's been upward blips in the domestic prices of gasoline and oil, some of them no doubt connected to what happened with the Ukrainian drone attacks on the refineries. But that does seem to be in decline again, and I doubt that that was ever, by the way, an especially significant factor. And she said that because of this upward blip, the central bank has slowed the pace of interest rate reductions this year. But she indicated that interest rates will continue to fall throughout 2026, and she predicts 4% inflation in the second half of 2026. In other words, inflation in Russia returned to target, and with economic growth returning, or rather accelerating again next year. So the Russians don't seem to be particularly fazed by the sanctions announcement, or by what they now anticipate will be more sanctions to come. They have concluded that Trump is indeed now on the escalation escalator where sanctions are concerned, having imposed sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil. He is certain to move on and impose more sanctions still. He can hardly do otherwise because even as his existing sanctions fail or prove ineffective, since he has now embraced sanctions as his main policy instrument against the Russians, he has no real option but to go on increasing them or admit to something which he will never admit to. No Western government up to now has ever wanted to admit to the fact. He is not going to be prepared to admit to the fact that the sanctions that he has imposed have been ineffective and have failed. And that all but guarantees that sanctions on Russia will grow. And the Russian Foreign Ministry, very interestingly, said yesterday that not only do they not believe that these are targeted and temporary sanctions, they believe, on the contrary, that these are permanent and systematic sanctions, that they are part of a long-term economic war that the West will continue to wage against Russia. They don't expect sanctions policy to be relaxed or to change, and the Russians will continue, therefore, to shape their economic policy on that basis and also to develop their trading relations with other countries, with India, with China, with Indonesia as well. There's apparently been more discussions about economic cooperation with Indonesia over the last few days. And all of that now for Russia is the long term. Relations, economic relations, the assumption that there was going to be a détente or rapprochement with the United States, and that one day economic relations with the United States would blossom. Well, that idea is now apparently in the process of being abandoned. And apparently, and I say apparently because this has not been said in any public venue, but apparently, Kirill Dmitriev, Putin's envoy, who has just been to the United States and has had several meetings there, has come back to Moscow and has provided a report to Putin and to the Russian Security Council, which has apparently said that from his meetings in Washington, Dmitriev has concluded that Trump has been entirely captured by the neocons and by the Europeans. An attempt, supposedly, to persuade the US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to establish some kind of regular contacts with the Russian Defense Minister Andrei Belousov was unsuccessful. And Hegseth apparently, over the course of some sort of discussion in which Dmitriev perhaps participated, made it clear that the United States considers Russia an adversary. Now, I should say that none of this has appeared in the Russian media, at least not that I'm aware of, but it has been discussed and spoken about by Alistair Crook, a former British diplomat, somebody who, unlike me, does have high-level contacts in Moscow and who is in regular touch with people there. And it is from him that I get this information that Dmitriev has provided to the Kremlin this report. It is consistent with everything from Dmitriev that I have heard, and it is also consistent with the latest language that is coming from the Russian Foreign Ministry and the Russian intelligence agencies and from the Kremlin. Now, the main spokesman, the person who's doing most of the talking at the moment, is Lavrov. Putin is remaining very quiet, but Lavrov has been in Minsk. He's attended the International Conference on Eurasian Security, which will include representatives from China and India and the Central Asian states and probably Iran. And Lavrov made the usual very negative comments about NATO expansion. NATO expansion has not halted for a single moment, despite promises made to Soviet leaders that the alliance would not move an inch east. Moreover, this ongoing expansion flagrantly disregards the highest level commitments within the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which stipulate not to bolster one's own security at the expense of others or pursue regional and global dominance. And then Lavrov went on to say that the overwhelming majority of NATO and EU countries refuse to acknowledge the reality that Western dominance has ended and a new historical era has dawned. This marks a fundamental difference between them and Russia, Russia's CIS partners, China, India, Iran, North Korea, and other Eurasian states, who are convinced that the key to Eurasia's stability and prosperity lies in strict respect for the principles of sovereign equality and indivisibility of security for all, not just the select few who place themselves above the law and morality. It is not Russia's or our allies' fault. Interesting that he uses the word allies again. That international arms control agreements have been systematically undermined and ultimately abandoned in recent years. Now, the latter is perhaps an early indication that the Russians have given up expectations that the United States is going to agree to an extension of the New START Treaty, which is due to expire in February. Putin proposed that it be extended for 1 year, and Putin further proposed that that year be used to negotiate its replacement. There's been no response, no formal response to this offer from the United States. President Trump, in response to some comments from some questions from the American media, said that what Putin was proposing seemed like a good idea. But of course, that is not an agreement to begin negotiations, to agree to extend the START Treaty, or to do anything of that kind. It appears that Dmitriev came to Washington, again trying to remind American officials of this proposal from Putin. That might explain how it came about that he had some kind of contact, direct or indirect, with Hegseth. It's undoubtedly the case, because Dmitriev himself has said as much, that the Russians have deployed, or are in the process of deploying, the new Burevestnik nuclear-powered cruise missile. And it seems as if Dmitriev was trying to get the Americans to understand the implications of this. But again, it seems that the Americans just weren't listening, weren't showing much interest in this discussion at all. And well, overall, and in summary, I think we can now definitely say that the entire process that began in Anchorage, the meeting between Putin and Trump that took place there, that the momentum has indeed stalled, as the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said 2 weeks ago, that the apparent attempt to get the Alaska process back on track, the call between Putin and Trump, the brief idea of holding a summit meeting in Budapest, all that, it seems, has come to an end. It seems that for the moment, we're back essentially to where we were in the time of Joe Biden, a situation where the Americans, the President of the United States, is having a tremendous sense of, grievance against the Russians for not capitulating to his demands, and that proper contacts between the Americans and the Russians have, to all intents and purposes, stopped. Lavrov has also, by the way, said that the Americans have been entirely unresponsive to suggestions of reopening air links between Russia and the United States, and nobody in Moscow apparently believes has any longer hopes or expects that that is going to happen, or that work in sorting out the problems of the embassies, the American embassy in Moscow, the Russian embassy in Washington, nobody any longer seriously believes that that is going to happen anytime soon. So we are back in deep freeze. The 9 months of intense diplomatic activity between the Americans and the Russians that followed Trump's inauguration have come to nothing. And we are back now simply to the Biden policy, sanctions, and war. Anyway, before I proceed with this, just a few further points. Lavrov again pointedly said that the Russians agree with the Americans that a summit meeting between Putin and Trump only makes sense if there is a clear pathway to an agreement. And he pointedly said that the pathway to an agreement was the one that was agreed between Putin and Trump in Alaska on the basis of an American proposal. The proposal that Witkoff brought with him to Moscow before the summit meeting in Alaska took place, the proposal that Putin systematically went through when he met Trump and Witkoff in Alaska, the one which Witkoff confirmed Putin had understood properly, and confirmed in Trump's presence Putin had understood properly. The one which Putin said that Russia would be prepared to accept, and the one which Donald Trump then reversed himself on. Now, none of this, none of the comments that I've discussed yesterday in my program, Lavrov's explanation of what really happened in Alaska, the actual discussions which took place between Putin and Trump, the discussions which took place before that between Putin and Witkoff, none of that has got through to any part of the Western media that I'm aware of. The fact that Witkoff brought to Moscow a proposal that Putin told Witkoff that it was a proposal that the Russians were prepared to consider, and that over the course of the meeting in Alaska, the Russians indicated that they would agree to the proposal. And the proposal, by the way, quite obviously, is Istanbul Plus, with some modifications on the territorial issue, a ceasefire in Kherson and Zaporozhye region, in return for a Ukrainian pullout from Donbass. Anyway, none of that has appeared anywhere in the media in the West. What we got instead, about 2 weeks ago, was an entirely untrue account of what happened in Alaska in the Financial Times, which claimed that Putin gave Trump a boring lecture on the history of Ukraine and of Ukraine's interactions with Russia, and that Trump got angry and frustrated and was almost on the brink of walking out of the room, and that that was the reason why Trump cut the summit short. Looking back, taking into account all that has happened over the last 2 weeks, it's not difficult to see how deeply embarrassed Trump himself is by his volte-face, his complete reversal, his decision to row back on an offer he made to Putin, and which Putin actually accepted. And one could see that article in the Financial Times now bears all the hallmarks of being an attempt to cover up what really happened in Alaska, the extent of Trump's reversal of his offer after it had been accepted. In effect, his betrayal of Putin and of the whole discussion that took place in Alaska. Now, it is important to say, though, that the rest of the world knows the truth. I say the rest of the world because what happened after Alaska is that Putin came back to Moscow, gave a detailed report of what happened in Alaska to the Russian leadership. You can still find the film of this, or the partial film of this, on the Kremlin's website. And then, over the course of the following 2 weeks, Putin telephoned all the various world leaders who were Putin's and Russia's friends. So, amongst others, for example, he telephoned President Xi of China, Prime Minister Modi of India. He telephoned and spoke to all the leaders of the Central Asian states. He explained it, as I remember, to the leaders of Iran and Turkey. Most of the world, at least at any rate the countries that matter, I think he also, from memory, spoke to many of the key leaders of the Arab states as well. They know what actually happened in Alaska because Putin told them at the time. And they know that Trump made an offer and that Putin accepted it, and that after Putin accepted the offer, Trump walked back on it. Trump has not only damaged his relations with the Russians, most of the leaders of the world will, of course, continue to work with him because he remains the president of the United States. And ultimately, the interactions between the Russians and the Americans are not their business. But according to the various Russian readouts, all of the leaders, all of the key leaders that Putin spoke to after Alaska, including Modi and Xi, praised the outcome of the meeting in Alaska in resounding terms. They did believe that a breakthrough had been achieved and that a major step had been made towards ending the conflict. And they will all know that Trump reversed his stance, broke his agreement with Putin, and therefore cannot be trusted. Xi will know it when he meets Trump in a few days in Seoul. Well, there we are. That's the makings of a diplomatic debacle. It has damaged Trump's international reputation, his deal-making skills. We see how the Chinese are already responding stiffly to false statements made by the US Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, about rare earths. We can see how Modi is now avoiding meetings with Trump, especially after Trump has made false claims about things that Modi is supposed to have said about Indian purchases of Russian oil. Just saying. I don't know to what extent Trump understands this, but whereas, as I well remember, first during his first term and at the start of his second term, he actually had a great deal of goodwill. There was a feeling amongst many world leaders that Trump, despite his well-known eccentricities, was nonetheless a person who didn't seem to have the arrogance and aloofness of Barack Obama or the manipulative and slippery side of Joe Biden, that he was, in other words, somebody that people could talk to and have discussions about and might even potentially reach agreements with. Anyway, that reputation, which of course many people in the West and in the United States will say was always unjustified anyway, that reputation has now taken a major knock. American power being what it is, some countries will still, through gritted teeth, continue to make deals with this president on trade issues and whatever. But those that have the power to avoid doing so will now start to distance themselves from him. Anyway, in the meantime, the war, as I said, goes on. And the Russian Defense Ministry has provided us with further updates of the progress of the battle. And in particular, it's provided us with an update, a detailed update of the situation in the Pokrovsk area. It says that in Pokrovsk, units of the Second Army continue to destroy encircled Ukrainian units in an urban area south of a railway, as well as near a railway station. The sub-district of Troyanda has been completely mopped up from Ukrainian militants. And that is a big district in southern Pokrovsk. We're talking about Pokrovsk south of the railway. Again, the defense ministry is not exactly precise where all of these battles in Pokrovsk are taking place. But the basic story, which is not really disputable, is that within Pokrovsk, the Russians are conducting mopping up operations, that they've encircled various Ukrainian units in various different places, that the whole of Pokrovsk is in a cauldron, that the Ukrainians have no means to exit, and it's now basically a question of the Russians mopping up. Rydovka, by the way, the Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, which has been a most interesting and, in my opinion, accurate reporter of the battle in Pokrovsk. They say that there is a wider cauldron, that the Ukrainians are indeed trapped in the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd conurbation, but that their units have also been separated from each other, that there is no single coherent defense force in Pokrovsk. And going back to an earlier report that Rydovka also gave some about 2 weeks ago, I seem to remember, all of the senior officers, the Ukrainian senior officers, were withdrawn from Pokrovsk. This is something, by the way, that regularly happens in battles. The Ukrainians have a practice which they have clearly been taught by the Americans of not exposing the officers to the first line of battle, so that the officers assume control of the battle from rear headquarters and the fighting is left in the hands of NCOs and unit leaders, in other words, of enlisted men. That was a system that worked quite well in the early weeks of the war, in the early months of the war in 2022. But apparently, what has happened since is that large numbers of Ukraine's best NCOs have been killed or wounded during the war. And the result is that Ukraine has a dearth now of competent small unit leadership. And the result is that in the absence of officers, the defense tends to fragment, with soldiers having less understanding of what it is exactly that they're supposed to do. Anyway, so that's one part of what the defense ministry said about the ongoing battle in Pokrovsk. But then it went on to say this. Assault groups of the 5th Separate Motorized Rifle Brigade of the 51st Army advancing in the eastern part of Mirnograd inflicted losses on Ukrainian units and pushed them out from positions in the area of Mine 5-6. This is obviously the Dmitrovsk mine. It is a way of essentially confirming that the Dmitrovsk mine, which is the major feature of Mirnograd, like all other mines in Donbass, it has a slag heap, and the slag heap dominates the surrounding landscape. Anyway, the Russians are saying here, the Russian Defense Ministry is saying here, that this mine has now been captured. And then the Defence Ministry goes on to say, the enemy's attempt to counterattack on armoured vehicles from the direction of Gryshino to unblock an encircled group of the Ukrainian military has been thwarted. Three attempts of Ukrainian armed formations to escape from the encirclement in a northern direction have been foiled. More than 180 troops, three armoured fighting vehicles and two pickup trucks were neutralised. Now, what the Russians are referring to here is a known counterattack that the Ukrainians carried out in the town of Rodinske, north of Pokrovsk. There is an accumulation of reports that the Russians are now in firm control of Rodinske. The Ukrainians apparently yesterday attempted to re-enter Rodinske, and the reason is that Rodinske, essentially, the capture of Rodinske by the Russians, essentially seals the cauldron, the Pokrovsk cauldron. There is actually film footage of Ukrainian armoured vehicles, of which, by the way, Ukraine has very few and is not getting significant replacements from the West anymore. But there is film footage of a Ukrainian armoured column trying to break into Rodinske. It was published by the Ukrainians themselves, I believe. And this showed footage of fighting between the Russians and the Ukrainians in Rodinske. The Russian Defense Ministry says that the attack failed, in fact, and that the parallel attempts by a Ukrainian force, presumably inside Pokrovsk, to advance north, presumably to Rodinske, to meet up with these advancing Ukrainian troops, was unsuccessful also. And then the Defense Ministry finishes by saying that more than 480 troops, four armoured fighting vehicles, four motor vehicles and one US-made 155mm M777 howitzer of the enemy have been neutralised in group of forces centres area of responsibility. And that, of course, the main area of that battle is Pokrovsk. Now, that suggests that the Russian vice around Pokrovsk is tightening. And in fact, there have been more reports to that effect from various bloggers and reporting channels as well. Now, there's also been the inevitable claims by the Ukrainians that they themselves are launching counterattacks in this area. And we see that the Russians have themselves confirmed one, though they say that this counterattack towards Rodinske was unsuccessful. But there have apparently, or there have been claimed to be, further Ukrainian counterattacks in the area of the Russian breakthrough in August. Though, again, it's very difficult to get a clear sense of what is going on there. It does seem that the Russians have pulled back from the village of Kucherov Yar, though it also seems that further east, the Russians are now in the process of capturing the much more important village of Sharkovo, that they've broken into Sharkovo, and that though bitter battles are taking place there, the Ukrainian forces in Sharkovo are themselves likely to be surrounded by the Russians before very long. Well, I'm not going to get into the weeds, as some do, and get into the very minute details of who's moving where in any particular battle in this area. I will simply say two things. Firstly, the Ukrainians have been launching counterattacks in this very same area since August. They've never been especially successful, or indeed at all successful. They've never managed to change the balance of the battle. And the last time that they did succeed in capturing a village that the Russians have captured, which is Vladimirovka, which is located to the west of Sharkovo, well, the Russians had little trouble later capturing it back. I strongly suspect that once this latest series of Ukrainian counterattacks exhaust themselves, we will see a Russian counterattack on places like Kucherov Yar and Zoloty Kolod Yar, a little further north, will very quickly once again fall back under Russian control. That is one thing. But the second thing, and it is perhaps an even more important point, is that this is the only area now along this entire enormous front line where there are clear reports of the Ukrainians attacking. There has been a monumental survey of the war by Big Serge on his Substack blog. Big Serge does this at a fairly regular intervals. He publishes enormously detailed accounts of the battles and gives a great overview of the state of the war. I'll return to that shortly. But he has made the same point that the Russian commentator Politayev made a couple of days ago, which I discussed in an earlier program, that perhaps the best sense, the clearest feeling about the way in which the war is changing is that this is the first year, 2025 is the first year of the war when the Ukrainians have failed to conduct a ground offensive of their own. They attempted, well, they carried out offensives in the autumn of 2022 in Kharkov region and Kherson region. They carried out their disastrous counteroffensive towards the Black Sea in the summer of 2023. And though it is universally overlooked, they also attempted an equally disastrous counteroffensive to try to recapture Bakhmut in the summer of 2023. That counteroffensive, the one seeking to recapture Bakhmut, by some accounts, by Russian accounts, actually cost the Ukrainians more men than the summer 2023 counteroffensive did. Just saying. And of course, the Ukrainians in the winter of 2023-2024 tried a counteroffensive in Kherson region. They landed troops in Kinkrinki, this village on the Russian-controlled east bank of the Dnieper, which also ended in a disaster. And in 2024, they launched their equally disastrous offensive in Kursk region. This year, the Ukrainians have not been able to conduct any offensives at all. They have conducted counterattacks like the ones we have seen since late August in this area northeast of Pokrovsk. Even those counteroffensives have had very limited success. In every other part of the battlefield, so far as I can see, the Russians have held the initiative continuously ever since the Russian offensive began in earnest in April. And Big Serge makes the point that this highlights the level of exhaustion of the Ukrainian army. And in fact, there's been further commentary about this. A Ukrainian MP who is a member of Zelensky's party says that in some Ukrainian battalions, there are only 7 infantry out of 150, 120 men that should be serving. By the way, if that is correct, then, I mean, Ukrainian battalions are, I mean, 120 men is, as far as I know, the size of a company, not a battalion. But anyway, he says that infantry, the number of infantry, is catastrophically low, that there are in many battalions now more officers than soldiers, that the Ukrainian military simply cannot function in this way, cannot hold positions in this way, and that the situation, therefore, is becoming more critical constantly. I mentioned how Maria Berlinskaya, the Ukrainian commentator, has also said that the defense lines are buckling. These are things that are being said by Ukrainian commentators, it should be stressed, not by Russians. And this shortage of troops, of infantry on the front lines, is, in my opinion, perhaps now, the clearest explanation of why the Ukrainians cannot afford to withdraw from the cities, the fortified cities, the fortified line in Donbass, from cities like Slovyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, and indeed Pokrovsk. Putting aside Zelensky's and Syrsky's adamantine rejection of even the smallest retreats, if the Ukrainians withdraw from the cities, if they lose the cover provided by the built-up areas, if they're caught by the Russians in open country, they simply don't have the manpower any longer to hold their positions. Now, to repeat again, this is based on information that has been provided by sources within Ukraine, by Ukrainian commentators, not by Russian ones. Anyway, that's the battle that is continuing to play out in Pokrovsk. Yesterday I mentioned that General Drapaty had apparently ordered the Ukrainian troops in Kupiansk to retreat, but there's no sign that they are in fact retreating. I doubt that they can retreat now, because all of the indications are that they are entirely trapped in a small territory in the industrial sector of Kupiansk on the east bank of the Oskol River. And there's been more news, extensive news, about fighting in the Liman area. Again, there's some reports of fighting inside Liman itself. But perhaps more interestingly, there are claims that the Russians are now also sending a force to recapture a town called Sviatogorsk, which is located to the west, to the northwest of Liman. And again, if you go to Big Serge's Substack blog, he explains the significance of a Russian capture of Sviatogorsk and of the way that the Russians today, with their drones operating from Sviatogorsk, would have little difficulty in interrupting supplies which continue to be sent to the Ukrainian grouping in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk via the roadways from the north. Sviatogorsk, which is a religious centre as well, by the way, is apparently even more important for the development of the battle than Liman itself is. Anyway, the fighting goes on. There's also reports of significant Russian advances in the Zaporozhye and Kherson areas, especially the Zaporozhye areas, but I'm going to skip those for discussion at a later day. I would like to make, however, one general comment and observation about the war. I have noticed that over the last couple of weeks, the narrative, the narrative that has been circulating in the West, that the war is proceeding at only a glacial pace, that the Russian advance is very slow, though some people who say that still acknowledge that there is a Russian advance. Anyway, many people continue to be frustrated by the slow pace of events. I will repeat a point I've made many times. Attrition wars tend to be very slow, but the collapse, when it comes, tends to be very sudden. And when it does come, defeat or victory follows very quickly. This has been the consistent pattern of attrition wars. The First World War, the American Civil War, other wars, the Spanish Civil War, the First World War. I have no reason to think that this one is any different. And the indications, the fact that the Ukrainians are, by their own admission now, so short of infantry, the fact that the Russians are now battling at the last line of defense in Donbass, that the Ukrainians are not any longer able to launch ground offensives, all of that tends to confirm this. Now, can you say something else too, which is that I have to say this. I think a lot of the commentary about war comes from people, this particular war comes from people in the English-speaking world, in Britain and in the United States. And, well, the Americans had a grueling attrition war, which was, of course, the American Civil War. And the British also fought through a grueling attrition war, which was, of course, the First World War. But these took place long ago in the past. And attrition war is not something that people in the English-speaking world have much knowledge or experience of. What most people in the English-speaking world are familiar with today are the various wars that the United States has fought basically since the start of the millennium. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. Before then, you could go back further still, talk about Panama and other such places. And it was the point about those wars is that the fighting, the big fighting, the fighting that attracts the attention, tends to happen very quickly, in about 1 or 2 weeks. Then the Western Army, the American Army, rolls in, the capital is captured, victory is proclaimed, and people tend to lose interest. And of course, not only do they lose interest, but very long, very soon, and very, very quickly, the political benefits, real or presumed, of these wars is reversed. And in one case, Afghanistan, after 20 years, of course, the war ended in straightforward defeat. But anyway, my point is that this is the idea that most people have of wars: large armoured columns, rapid movements, that kind of thing. As a Greek, my understanding of war is completely different, which is why I don't feel it in this way. For me, in my history, which of course extends back very far, war, attrition war, is very usual. It is very common. It is how wars are generally fought. And for a Greek, a 4-year war is not a long one. Not by any means. And I am sure that that is true of Russians and Ukrainians also. Just saying. So anyway, just to make that very quick little point. Now, one person who I get the sense is becoming increasingly alarmed about the situation is Vladimir Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. I think that over the last couple of days, he suddenly realized that there is indeed a major crisis in Pokrovsk. I wonder what General Sirsky has been telling him, and I wonder what the local commanders have been telling General Sirsky. Just saying. But anyway, Zelensky is now talking again about the need for a ceasefire. He says that Ukraine is going to work with the Western powers to draw up a plan for a ceasefire. He says it's going to be a very simple plan, but he expects in advance that the Russians are going to reject it, which really begs the question of what then is the point. And he also is saying some very strange things about the Battle of Pokrovsk. He says that the situation in Pokrovsk is critical. He gives the impression, as I said yesterday, that the Russians have only now broken into Pokrovsk. He then says that the Russian force that is operating inside Pokrovsk numbers all of 200 men, which is ridiculous. I am incredulous that these bizarre claims are being republished again in the Western media. It does make me wonder sometimes where the Western media gets its information. Just say. And I noticed that one article in the Financial Times, which did appear to acknowledge that there is indeed a critical situation in Pokrovsk, but which again repeated many of Zelensky's extraordinary claims, provoked some rather tart comments on the thread from various people who were saying, what is it with the Financial Times publishing information about a battle that anybody who has access to the internet and has any interest in the battle would know was taking place 2 weeks before this article appeared, and that it's high time that the Financial Times started to engage in some, well, shall we say, more modern journalism, more contemporary types of journalism. Anyway, going back to Big Serge's, as an absolutely monumental survey of the war, he makes a further point which I think is basically true and which derives from Ukraine's inability to mount offensives or ultimately to hold positions. Incidentally, I would say that though there are important nuances where Big Serge and I probably would not agree, both of us have a similar overall view that the Russian plan now is clearly the encirclement of the Ukrainian forces in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and that the battles of Pokrovsk and Liman, Kupiansk, Siversk, and perhaps before long Sviatigorsk are all basically intended to achieve that objective, and that this will be the decisive battle of the war. Anyway, Big Serge makes the point that there's been a massive, though unacknowledged, narrative change in the West. There is no longer any admission that there's no longer any claims or predictions that the Russian army can be defeated on the battlefields in Ukraine. He says that instead the entire strategy is to try to get the Russians to stop before they achieve the objectives that they have set themselves, and that this explains the resort to drone and missile strikes against the Russian energy system and the sanctions against the Russian energy industry. It's the plan now is essentially and almost exclusively, entirely, to inflict sufficiently heavy costs on the Russians to get them to stop rather than to actually defeat them on the battlefield. It is now essentially understood that that is impossible. And well, I think overall he is right about that. I would say that I'm not convinced that everybody in the West has completely given up in terms of the ground fighting. According to the Russian intelligence agency, the SVR, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, is still planning to send troops to Ukraine. He's no longer thinking of doing it in the context of a ceasefire. He's thinking of sending French troops whilst the war is underway, presumably in order to try to hold the Russian advance back. The report, the SVR report, is withering in its use of language, and we have extracts from it on TASS. And I'll just read some of them. Napoleon, Charles XII, Macron, a trajectory of decline. Charles XII was a Swedish king who was defeated by Peter the Great in a battle at a place called Poltava, which is now in Ukraine, just to say. According to information we have received, President Macron envisages a military intervention in Ukraine. Having failed as a politician and struggling to guide his country out of a prolonged socio-economic crisis, he has not abandoned his hope of going down in history as a military leader. The General Staff of the French Armed Forces is preparing to deploy a military contingent of up to 2,000 soldiers and officers to Ukraine to support the Kiev regime. The core of the force will be made up of assault troops from the French Foreign Legion. The legionaries are already stationed in regions of Poland bordering Ukraine and are undergoing intensive combat training, receiving weapons and military gear. Their redeployment to central Ukraine is planned for the near future. In France, hundreds of additional hospital beds are being rapidly created to accommodate the wounded. French doctors are undergoing specialized medical training for field work. Paris intends, in the event of a leak of intervention about the impending intervention, Paris intends to claim that this is merely a small group of instructors arriving in Ukraine to train mobilized Ukrainian soldiers. And the SVR continues. Macron is notorious for dreaming of Napoleon's laurels. However, he studied history poorly. Not only did he skip the textbook chapter describing the end of Napoleon's campaign in Russia, but he also skipped class on the attempt by the Swedish king, Charles XII, to defeat Russia, relying on the Ukrainian Hetman Ivan Mazepa, which ended with the Swedes' defeat in Poltava. Macron should know the words of the Russian historian Kluchevsky: history teaches nothing but only punishes for ignoring lessons. Well, I don't know whether Macron has these plans, but if he does, it would not surprise me in the least. And of course, if the SVR is correct, then he, at least, it seems, has not yet abandoned ideas of inflicting some kind of military defeat on the Russian army in Ukraine. But overall, going back to Big Serge, I think that he is right. He discusses at length Tomahawk missiles and appears to believe that they would be both effective, but only available in short supply. And he also is one of those who imagines or claims that there is a dearth of ground launchers to use with them. On the topic, by the way, of Tomahawk missiles being incredibly effective weapons, well, there is a curious article today in the Daily Telegraph discussing the Burevestnik nuclear-powered cruise missile and saying that it would not be an effective weapon if used against the West. And there's a quotation from an American military expert, William Albuquerque, senior associate at the Honolulu-based Pacific Forum think tank, and he's quoted as saying, "It, the Burevestnik, is essentially an aeroplane, and not even a stealthy aeroplane. Every kilometer it travels, you increase the chance of spotting it, and you increase the chances of spotting it. The age of subsonic cruise is kind of over, given the high rate of intercepts. I would want to shoot it down over Russian territory so that he can be with family and friends when it dies." That's what he has to say about the Burevestnik. Neither the Daily Telegraph nor Mr. Albuquerque seem to have noticed that exactly the same points, all of the same points, can equally be made about the Tomahawk. It too is subsonic. It too is relatively is not stealthy. It too can be easily seen or tracked over the enormous distances that it covers. If the Burevestnik can be disregarded as a threat in the way that Mr. Albuquerque says, well, surely the same applies to the Tomahawk too. I don't think the Burevestnik can be discounted. I think it is an extremely powerful and very dangerous weapon. I think the Tomahawk missile is less so, but I'm not going to spend more time discussing that here. Anyway, the point is that Ukraine has attempted to conduct missile and drone offensives of its own. They have not been particularly successful. I would say they've not been at all successful. And, well, I've spent a great deal of time in this program discussing the sanctions. And in fact, Big Serge ends his monumental, as I said, summary of the state of the war with this comment, with which I agree. The key point is that the concept of Ukraine victory has been completely transformed. There is now no real discussion of how Ukraine can win on the ground. For the pro-Ukrainian bloc, the war is no longer a contest against the Russian army, but a more abstract contest against Russia's willingness to incur strategic costs. Rather than preventing Russian capture of the Donbass, the West is testing how much Putin is willing to pay for it. If history is any guide, a game predicated on outlasting Russia's strategic endurance and willingness to fight is a very bad game to play indeed. And about that, I would agree. I don't myself think this is a strategy. I think a strategy of deep strikes against Russia, which would not succeed, and attempts to strangle the Russian energy industry, which will not succeed, and an attempt to strangle the Russian energy export trade, which also will not succeed, all based on a complete misunderstanding of the actual structure of the Russian economy, which is far more sophisticated and diversified than people in the West want to believe. Well, none of that is going to succeed. But to try to play this game against a country like Russia is a certain recipe for failure. Now, that apparently is what the President of the United States and his advisors, his top advisors, have now committed themselves to. As I said, the President has over high expectations of what India is going to do, and absurdly over high, in fact, simply mistaken expectations of what China is going to do. And if he believes, as apparently many people in Washington are telling him, that the situation in Donbass is one of stalemate, that the Russians are indeed bogged down there, well, he is very much mistaken. At some point in the next few months, the full scale of his miscalculation is going to be clear to him. He could have had peace in Alaska. I think that is now clear. He'd reached or had got Putin to agree to a deal which he proposed. He threw that away. I doubt that there will be any other chance like that. And the price of that miscalculation is going to be an enormous one. Anyway, this is where I finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.